I am here with Alexia Vuici. She is an investment associate at Multicoin Capital. Alexia, I'm so excited to have you on the pod.
Nailed it. That was
cool. I was practicing.
Yeah, it's honestly, it's anyone who can say my name properly gets a full 10 out of 10. Like a full 10 out of 10 immediately. So the certain J's, they really throw everyone. But I'm excited to be here.
Yes, I cannot wait to dive into all of the things. Before we get into it, and you wrote this really great piece about user-generated content to user-generated products, and I want to unpack it all. But before we do that, maybe you can give a little bit of context on you and how you fell down the crypto rabbit hole.
Yeah, 100%. I love that that's the term that we've all just decided to use. Like, and it's like, and then I fell down the crypto rabbit hole. Okay, here we go. Okay, so mine starts, obviously I'm Serbian, that's why my name is that way, but I came to the US to go to UCLA, and right after that graduated and started my own consumer company. So the idea was to basically start Goop, but for girls between the ages of 12 to 19, Goop for teens. And I exited that, raised some money, exited that, and then went on to consult for other startups in the consumer space across beauty, fashion, wellness, whatever. And then realized that advice is nice, but money is better, and that I wanted to get into venture capital. So I went to get my MBA, and I refused to leave New York, which is where I live right now. So I went to NYU, obviously, because I was like, I also can't go to the Upper West Side. That would be ridiculous. I didn't even apply to Columbia. So I went to Stern, got my MBA, and while I was doing my MBA, switched into traditional kind of Web 2 venture capital, and just realized that this is my rabbit hole moment. Just realized that a lot of the companies that we were looking at and that we were considering for investment had so many what I considered to be irreconcilable issues that it was like a Web3 fixes this moment, our other favorite statement. It was just things like I was looking at, for example, I'm really interested in P2P commerce and enabling P2P commerce across social commerce platforms. Like Xiaohongshu, which I've probably butchered the pronunciation of, but in China is one of my favorite apps. And just nothing like that can function in the US right now with the way that platforms work, ownership works, the ability to buy, sell, trade in open markets works. Obviously, all of the issues with consumers owning their data and their kind of identity online. Fucking Linktree, excuse my language. Are we allowed to swear?
Fully. It's actually encouraged.
Okay. Linktree is the worst product. And the fact that we have to use that on all these platforms, we have no other options. I just was like, there's got to be a better way. And Web3 felt like that way. So when I graduated from my MBA last year, I was basically exclusively for Multicoin. And I joined the team to build out the consumer arm alongside Kyle and obviously others on the team. But that's exclusively what I focus on now. So I always joke that I get to do the fun stuff at work.
Yes. I also feel like it's a very rare rabbit hole to go through consumer, do something meaningful and be like, okay, I'm actually realizing that Web3 like solves a bunch of these problems. I feel like a lot of times it's like highly technical people who are like, ooh, distributed systems. Let's fucking go.
100%. Which by the way, I am absolutely not a technical person, but but I think that that's partially my superpower. Like my understanding is so, so consumer centric, consumer behavior centric. I fundamentally don't really understand a lot of the deep, deep technical, obviously I understand the superficial, but like deep technical stuff, nor do I frankly care. But like no one else does either. So I'm the base case. Like if I don't get what you're talking about, no one's gonna get what you're talking about.
Yes, I love that. We need more of you in crypto.
I am the mom test. I am the mom test. It's me, actually.
I love that. But also, I'm curious, like, when you think about the whole, okay, Web3 solves this type thing in consumer, like, what were some of the things that you were running into where it became, like, abundantly clear that Web3 was something that needed to exist?
I think that that's kind of what I was getting into earlier, like, things just about ownership, deplatforming, et cetera. That's really obvious. But then, like I said, P2P commerce is something I'm really focused on. And not only the inability to pull from an open catalog of products, because that doesn't exist, then create your own kind of shop, let's call it, just the ability to sell where and when you want to sell products doesn't exist. because you don't have tokenized assets. You don't have a ledger that like tracks the buying and selling of all of these goods. There's no permissionless trading. None of these things exist in Web2, and Web3 fixes all of that. There's also even, I'm really interested in fashion. There's so much to do with digital fashion, AR, provenance, ownership, secondary markets. ESG, to a certain extent, I have a lot of thoughts about digital fashion and ESG that I don't think digital fashion people love. But all of that was like issue after issue after issue that Web3 fixes this, Web3 fixes this, Web3 fixes this. Even, I don't know, just like the future of consumer brands. I think that that's actually, this kind of gets us, not to jump the gun a little bit, but into co-creation of, there was so much that in the brand consumer relationship, the consumer was giving and the brand was profiting from, that the end consumer wasn't in turn profiting from. And again, Web3 fixes this. It's just, we as consumers do so much already for brands every single day. It's not tracked. It's not attributed. It's not rewarded. And Web3 solves a lot of those issues, which I think that's what kind of, that was the impetus in part for the co-creation piece, is tracking what consumer brand relationships have looked like over time and how it's not really a case of that behavior fundamentally transforming, but rather it being recognized and rewarded finally.
Yeah, totally. I want to dive into that piece because I thought the evolution from this like acknowledgement that the consumer is not only getting something from actually buying from companies, but is also providing a lot, was really interesting. And then how that sort of moves into co-creation. So maybe we can start in this piece. You kind of give like a quick history of consumer products and brands and how co-creation has sort of manifested and existed up until this point. So sort of like the Web2 and pre-Web2. So maybe you can give a little bit of context on that, and then we can dive into the Web3 possibilities.
Totally. I will try to be succinct because I feel like I could go on about this for a very long time. But if we go all the way back, we have time. Okay, perfect. If we go all the way back, like, brands have obviously always existed. There's always been such a thing as a brand. But I think there's a difference between a label, a company name, a general like light sort of identity, and the brand we started seeing in specifically the 50s. And the impetus for that is something that Mark de Swan Aaron catalogs really well in a piece in The Atlantic that I actually link in my piece, where he talks about in the 50s, that's when quality actually became kind of ubiquitous. So instead of having 50 pasta sauces where one pasta sauce was markedly better than another, and you went a little bit for brand, but mostly because you associated brand with quality, quality really became standard across the board. And so you started going exclusively for brand. And that was the step change when brand became that much more important. So now you have brands, the only way that they can differentiate themselves is not their products, but the brand itself. And that moves into the next kind of phase of evolution of brands that then Toby Shoren, who I'm a total fangirl. He doesn't know who I am, but like, Toby, I know who you are. He catalogs really well on his piece. There's two. There's Life After Lifestyle and there's After Authenticity, which I've read like 10 times each. And I still feel like there are little nuggets of wisdom that I pull out every time. So highly recommend. But he talks about how all of a sudden it wasn't enough to just be a brand. You needed it to be a brand that was associated with a lifestyle, with a culture. And so brands started attaching themselves to subcultures. And there's a lot of writing about subculture on the internet, but it was like Outdoor Voices became the kind of like outdoorsy, cool hiker scene. And then whatever, Patagonia did the same. And you chose your subculture and you made that kind of your niche and you embodied a lifestyle more than you embodied just a brand. Then we move past that. And then all of a sudden, it wasn't enough to just be subcultures because consumers are greedy. All of a sudden, you had to create culture. How do you create culture? We've always created culture through content. That's when you do the whole like Gutenberg press, blah, blah, blah reference. Culture has basically been top down. It's been created through magazines. It's been created through writing. It's been created through art and photography and fashion. And culture was top down. And so brands started creating culture through content. But what happened was then social media came around and all of a sudden content wasn't created top down. Content was created bottom up. And then culture started being created bottom up as well. So who is creating culture? Consumers. So brands were forced to effectively co-create culture and co-create content on social media together. And that's when you started getting UGC. So that's the first iteration of user-generated content. It was like, go out in the wilderness and take a photo of you in your Outdoor Voices leggings, hiking, I don't know, Mount Kilimanjaro. You know what I mean? And that was how consumers initially started really participating in brands with brands. But then there was a natural progression on social media of all of a sudden it was like, I'm not just posting myself in my leggings. I'm commenting on Outdoors Voices posts saying, I really love these leggings, but I wish they came in these colors. I wish that maybe you would actually make a dress that I could exercise in. What if you did this? And it turned from user-generated content to user-generated products. We were actually building these brands alongside the brands, but like is pretty much always the case, weren't being, again, attributed or rewarded for that at all. And I think you see that in a lot of different instances. Like, for example, Soho House. You comment on a Soho House post and you're like, we would really love to see a Soho House in Istanbul. Like, you know what would be nice in a Soho House is if we had places to take calls, which still a bane of my existence. And it just naturally progressed from there to the point where we have been co-creating with brands for so long, but no one has given us the credit kind of where credit is due. So that was a little bit long, but I think that answers like the first part of your question.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because like to some degree as a consumer, 100%, I think this makes sense. And there's like a funny dynamic where still I think a lot of the tangible product decisions that might be made that are like, you know, consumers requested this type of different dress from Outdoor Voices. Like Outdoor Voices as a, I don't know them specifically as a brand, whether or not they do this, but a lot of brands do this where it's like, we listened to you. Like it's almost like appeasing people in a weird way, which is like very different.
But it's like consumers want credit. And brands recognize that. And the way that they've been doing it is sending you emails to your point being like, you asked, we listened. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I'm so sick of that email subject line. And also, is that really the best? If you are listening, if we asked and you listened, it was our idea. And I think another great example of that, for example, is Starbucks had an idea platform from, I think it was like 2006, 2012. And people literally submitted ideas for the things they wanted. Basically like a chat box. And then those things came to life. Cake Pops was some consumer's idea. Free Wi-Fi, consumer idea. The caramel frappuccino, some little consumer made that in their home and then sent it in and Starbucks made it. Do you think they're getting any benefit from the fact that now caramel frappuccinos are sold all over the world? Like, obviously not. But should they? Yes. And like, does it have to be monetary? Not necessarily. I think that this is something that we can get into. There's so many ways to reward consumers that isn't just rev share, which is for sure one of the pillars, but doesn't have to be the only one. But like, for goodness sakes, they should get something.
Totally. You also referenced Glossier in the article, which I think is really interesting from the perspective of like, I feel like people, you know, Starbucks is an interesting example. Brands like that and Glossier, people like ride hard for. And so it's interesting that they have been able to build a culture, period, that is so strong that people want Starbucks to like make the drink that they make at home. Like that is alone fascinating.
Totally. And it's a great sign for like these brands communities. I actually think the Glossier point is a good one because what you saw post Instagram was that a lot of these brands moved to Discord, Geneva, a lot of these kind of community chat platforms, and they started engaging their most highly engaged consumers and then asking them for feedback. Like Ceremonia is this really great Latinx hair care brand who was sending products to their community prior to fully launching them, asking for feedback and reviews on these products. And like, that's labor. You know what I mean? Like Ceremonia was rewarding them because they were getting these free products and they would get rewards later. But like, that is labor. We are doing labor all the time for our brands. And then we are paying them for that privilege, which is so crazy.
Yeah. So crazy. Yeah. And I think the thing that's interesting about your piece is that you talk about attribution and co-creation and what all of that can look like. So maybe let's first dive into your vision for attribution and then we can talk the different like modes of co-creation that you sort of lay out in the piece.
Yeah. So I think that there's two main types of attribution. There's social and financial, right? Those are kind of the types of recognition. I think Sari is out, has a really great piece called Attribution Plus that kind of talks about this. And she talks about how there's like a quote that she says where it's like the true power of Web3 is the ability to reshape how value is created, shared, and then distributed. And that distributing value should be as easy as sending and receiving an email. And that's exactly what I think is what's going to happen in Web3. And the way that that's done is typically through tokens. So tokens enable brands to not only attribute social recognition through the recording of provenance and also the origination point of ideas, but also then route that financial or other value to those who own the ideas. So we see that, like, basically, if you tokenize products, which is what I see for the future, that all the goods that you sell on the internet will be tokenized. They'll be kind of NFTs. You'll sell this shirt as an NFT. You'll sell whatever it is as an NFT. That NFT can own who was the originator of the product. And maybe there were many. How is financial and other value being routed to those people once it's sold? And then three, how does provenance of that good evolve over time? And you can kind of create almost like a tracking. I mean, literally like a ledger for ideas, which is what's really exciting. And so I kind of talk about three, I think that there are three levels of co-creation. There's individual, there's cohort, and then there's community. So individuals kind of remixing. You create a TikTok, that TikTok is tokenized. I remix your TikTok. I add a dance. Now it's almost like I've added a layer to your original product, but both of those layers should exist in the next iteration of the product that's sold. And then maybe rev share is split according to those parts or what have you. Maybe it's just social, but in that way, we're able to track who contributed to the idea and then who sold it and who bought it and how everything flowed through that. Cohort creation will be when multiple people in a small selected group come together to create, maybe it's like a collection of clothing. So Effect is a platform that's trying to do this for fashion. 20 people come together, they do a clothing collection, maybe in partnership with The Row, for example. And then you get to see in every piece from The Row who was involved, what they contributed to it. And then they get, every time one of those things are sold, they get a small piece of financial value. And then the final is community co-creation. And that's when you get to brands, which I think in the future will have brands that are fully community owned. Everything is to a certain extent voted upon. And then that community receives value in return, which we can get into that kind of later, but there's a spectrum of decentralization. And from products to brands, it's actually very difficult to figure out what the perfect spot on that spectrum is, because there's a stupid quote about horses and cars. Like, does the average consumer actually know what they want? So there was this study, not to kind of get on a tangent really quickly, but there's this really interesting study that I think they were Norwegian artists. I can look for it. It was in this piece called The Age of Average. It's super depressing if you want like a really sad Sunday read. They were Russian. Two Russian artists did this study about trying to figure out what consumers wanted from paintings. And they went across the world in almost, it was like 16 or 20 different countries. And they asked people, what colors do you want? Would you want landscapes or portraits? How like bright do you want it to be, et cetera. And basically every single person ended up coming back to the same point that converged on the same piece of art, which was like light blues, landscape, not that many people, the ocean. And it's just like, are we actually maybe, is the majority of taste actually just average? And if we just let free reign to the average person, will products and brands in turn be average? And do you need someone who maybe goes against the grain to create products and brands that aren't average? And so that's a really hard, there's a lot of tension to deal with. And I think that the answer is of course, like everything, somewhere in the middle. But finding that is going to take a lot of experimenting, to be honest.
It's like finding it, the answer to that is somewhere in the middle. But the reason that it needs to be somewhere in the middle is so that you don't end up somewhere in the middle in terms of taste, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We go to the middle so we don't get to the average. That's totally. Kind of like the delineation there.
Totally. Yeah. And I think in the context of like creators more broadly, I think it's been interesting to watch this over the last few years. And I would actually be very curious how you think about like the, I'll take a step back and explain the context, but then I'll follow up with this question. So the reason I think of this is because I think oftentimes creators become the average of what their audience wants from them. And I think it actually ends up being very challenging for creators to do something that is either meaningful to them, interesting, or not incredibly radical. Like, I feel like you either end up as an average in a way that is like kind of boring and not that interesting, or you end up very, very radicalized, which is like also probably not optimal for you as a human and what you want. And so in that way, I wonder how much you think some of this stuff applies to like individuals as brands, as it does to brands themselves, if that makes sense. Like when I think about, you know, of course it makes sense for Outdoor Voices to do some of the stuff in Glossier. But when I also think about like, what does this mean for someone like Emma Chamberlain or like, you know, these larger content creators who are themselves also brands and probably could engage with some of these co-creation mechanisms.
Yeah. So first, just what you said about like either doing the average or doing something radical reminds me weirdly of, it's like not a direct relationship or association, but I don't know if you ever read My Body by Amrata, but she has this really interesting point about how her art teacher told her when she was doing art, she was painting the female kind of nude. He was like, either play into the idealized version of the female body or show why it's oppressed. Those were like really the two options, and you can't play somewhere in the middle. And that's kind of what your comment reminds me of, is like play to the interests of your fans or do something extremely outside of that. And I will start off by saying that I think, unfortunately or fortunately, creators are brands. And so I think that we should treat them as such. And I think that the answer for both ends up being kind of universal across the board, which is that I think that there will be experiments, like I said, in fully community-owned brands. I think Pool Suite is one of the best examples where they're working towards that kind of future. And I think that that's super interesting. And I think a lot of beautiful things will be born out of that. Do I think that will be the norm and that every brand will be that way? Absolutely not. Do I think they even should be that way? Absolutely not. I think that we need tastemakers who are willing to think outside of the box, who proliferate their taste in a more top-down manner. But my point is more that community, like I said from the beginning, has always been engaged, and just rewarding them for that engagement as it stands is what we should aim for. And it's like, if they're giving you suggestions that you take, if they give you products that you end up making, or ideas or requests or whatever it might be, like reward them for that. It will create not only a more like a happier customer, but also you will retain that customer better, like a longer life for that consumer. And I think that that ends up being more valuable to consumer and brands. There's kind of this idea that a dollar, a new dollar from a net new customer isn't actually as valuable as the second dollar from an already existing consumer. And often that second dollar, well, ideally should be a little bit easier to get. And I think that co-creation helps you get that second dollar and re-engage your community and basically like farm, which is a horrible word, but like farm your community for further consuming. Like it's a net, it's a positive for brands, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, well, the other interesting thing here is like to the point about, you know, brands who are able to actually get community feedback, like that's a very good sign. I think this idea of like, quote unquote, farming your community, which I kind of love, even though I know it's like,
it has such a negative connotation, but
yes, but it's actually a very good term. And what it kind of makes me think of is like, maybe the end state that we're moving towards is just like cults, like not actually, but kind of, where how can you really deeply engage people and make them feel not just like you're creating something for them, but like they're also creating value. Yeah. Like there's this like conversation almost that starts to happen when you co-create with your consumers.
Absolutely. And by the way, Toby would definitely agree with you. Obviously a lot of his work has been done kind of on cults, and then he works backwards from there, which I think there are a lot of things to be learned. Like, yeah, cults is kind of a negative word. Farming's not maybe the best word, but like, we can look at farming in a positive way. You are tilling and growing your community in a positive way, not just extracting. But I think that's right. I think that it's really all about, I think people take like co-creation to this weird level and they're like, well, if you just like hand it over to your consumers, who knows what you're going to get in return? And I'm like, you always know what you're going to get in return. You are actually still in control of which ideas you take and which ideas you don't. It's just about rewarding for the ideas that you do take. And to your point, consumers want to engage with their favorite brands. They are consistently, and creators, like I said, they're all brands, musicians, artists, creators, influencers, brands. People want to engage with them. Give them new ways to do that and then recognize them for doing so. And you create a higher value consumer in the end.
Yeah. And I want to go back to this idea that you kind of alluded to around like levels of decentralization, what it really means. Because when I think about like, you are in control no matter what, I think from the consumer perspective, that's like, oh yeah, thank God. From the Web3 perspective, that's like a red flag. And so I'm curious how you think about that like trade-off across the scale from, you know, individual to more cohort-based creation to this like community-oriented co-creation and what the involvement of like the operators, quote unquote, the people who are executing kind of can be across that scale.
I am by no means a decentralization maxi. I don't think that it's useful in a lot of consumer, frankly. Like I think that the best products, best ideas, et cetera, have come from centralized people, centralized product projects, et cetera. Where I think decentralization is helpful is redistributing attribution and value and routing that back to a broader community past one person or one project. And I think that the spectrum is the same across individual cohort and community. The likelihood is that you move further down that spectrum as you get towards community. But I think that the brands ultimately are the ones that get to make the decision about how decentralized they want to be and then put in the technology or the standards or the whatever it might be in place to enforce that level of decentralization. So when you come to, for example, when we start with individual remixing, let's talk about, for example, the Nike Air Force Ones. You could have it such that you give everyone a blank template. Everyone has to design their own Air Force Ones. And then that's the end of the project. That's pretty permissioned. You could also make it where everyone gets to design their own Air Force Ones. Everyone gets to sell them if they want. Everyone has the opportunity to turn that into a real product. Or you could make it where the community gets to vote on which of the best designed Air Force Ones get to be turned into real projects. There's just a lot of, like I said, ways that you can balance the scale a little bit towards and away from the centralization to make it to benefit the brand and the consumer based on what their end goal is. If you are building a fully decentralized community, I think that there's a project called Deep Objects AI, where they're using AI to create brand identity, colors, fonts, design, et cetera, where people now can use AI to design completely new products, a completely new brand as a community, work together on that, and then sell those goods. And AI helps you get over the kind of obstacles, which by the way, that has been one of the issues, is the barriers to entry for design, for fashion, for consumer goods, et cetera, have been super high in the past because it's difficult to design. Not everyone has the skills. It's really hard to, never mind make digital products, but real products. And you get to now overcome a lot of those. And that makes the ability to design a new brand as a community a lot easier. And so I just think it's a choice. And people get really nervous. And they're like, well, if it's not fully decentralized, not everyone owns this, that, and the other thing. And it's like, they don't need to, frankly. And nor do they want to. I think that Jess and Josh talked about this, not only on your podcast, but they've talked about a bunch of things from Seed Club about how like, we kind of all in the beginning were like, people want ownership. And it's like, no, they don't. They want ownership experiences. They want to feel like owners, but they don't actually want to do the work of owners, except in very specific cases. And like, give them those cases, let them go design a brand if they want to, but otherwise don't make them.
Yeah, totally. I am curious, like, I think about on like the sort of scale of what's possible when it comes to decentralization, it does feel like very internet native, like products basically and brands feel slightly easier to do in a more distributed fashion. Whereas, like, obviously, if you are making clothing, there are, you need more checks and balances. Like, the cost of production alone makes that very different. And so I'm curious how you think about, like, different types of consumer products and how that changes how co-creation might actually happen.
I think I've thought of it approximately as deeply as you have, as the delineation between truly digital goods and then non-digital goods. Truly digital goods, I think, especially with step function changes in AI, will allow, again, the barrier to entry to be so much lower, such that anyone, anywhere can create and sell a digital product. And that makes it a lot easier for then a community or a cohort or an individual to come together to co-create. When you get to physical goods, I think more likely than not, we're going to need a centralized entity at one end to actually organize and produce that good. And again, I think that that's okay. I really don't think that that's a bad thing.
Totally. Yeah. And I think, like, and I guess, I don't know if we've actually said it, but, like, the term that you use for this is, like, user-generated products, which I think is really interesting. And when I think back to, like, what it meant to grow up on the internet, I think what's fascinating about this shift is that until this, basically, until Web3 and until we've really started to see, like, potentially things like attribution hopefully become more common, it wasn't really possible to create much on the internet other than content. At least not in a way where, like, if you think about creation as, like, oh, you also have attribution. Mm-hmm. You know, like, did the person who, like, gave the idea for the Frappuccino, the caramel Frappuccino, did they create it? I don't know. Not really. But if I think about what's possible with something like this, it's, like, incredibly different as just an experience on the internet. And I think that's, like, a subtle shift, but it's absolutely massive when you think about what one, like, 15-year-old can do on the internet.
And that's why I keep going back to AI. I think that AI is what really creates that shift overall, because now you have to have, you can have, like, actually zero skill in design, production, or otherwise, and still be able to your point, actually create a product. And I think we're starting to see that with the deep objects, with the latest Nike release with the OF1s. Like, that's huge. The ability to design your own Air Force from the ground up and then vote on that as a community and possibly see your design sold in Nike stores. Like, you created that and it required very little skill on your end. Effect, they also use AI. Tribute Labs, that's another brand where they're working, they've trained their own Gen AI model. They're using it in their Discord. They're working with their community. The community is submitting prompts, creating digital products, and then Tribute is creating fidgetal versions of that product. And, like, that cohort created that product. There's absolutely no ifs, ands, or buts about it. And I think that that's really what's going to be super cool.
Yeah, it feels like part of what this actually gets down to is, as you have things like AI, but also, like, In a way, you could start to see the company that produces, for example, the Air Force Ones that a community voted on, in this case, Nike. Like, Nike then just becomes this container, right, for people to, like, basically put ideas into. And it kind of makes me start to think, like, for a long time, I think it was, we very much had the perspective, especially in, like, the Silicon Valley, whatever vibe, that, like, ideas are cheap, execution is hard. And it feels like we're actually kind of moving towards, in some ways, especially as we're able to automate this stuff and create these containers for it, this idea that, like, no, actually ideas are slowly becoming the thing and execution is just, like, cheap and easy, which feels like a massive paradigm shift.
I think that you're right on the ideas becoming more valuable. I think execution is still hard to a certain extent because you have to create that shell. Like, you have to have the logistics in place if you're a Nike for that chat box to be a seamless experience, right? Like, you have to have the brand identity, the all the way down to the factories, right? Like, you have to have that stack kind of, and then people just submit their ideas and you make execution easy for them. But I think that's what the future kind of community created brands will be, is you create the framework around which ideas can be executed. And that's kind of, that's what your value as an entrepreneur in that specific instance would be, is making execution easy. And, but the ideas then, to your point, become more valuable. And then we can attribute them in turn. It kind of reminds me, I think we were maybe talking about this a little bit before, but I think that the relationship between brands and consumers, that's the other things that people love to just take this to the extreme. And they're like, oh, brands will never exist anymore. And I'm like, brands absolutely will exist, because brands are still fundamental to co-creating that culture with us and creating these like lifestyles and these cultures. And a lot of the reason that we wear brands is because they signal a certain status that we want to associate ourselves with. And that's actually the crux of, because I've been thinking a lot about this, is, okay, it's very, we've been arguing even in this podcast about why brands should co-create with consumers, but we take it for granted a lot about why consumers want to co-create with brands in the first place. And the reason for that, I think, that I've been mulling over kind of, is the status that that grants you as a consumer. So I've been thinking about this idea that we've moved on social media away a little bit from content creation and into content curation. There's kind of an overproliferation of content on the internet, and that's going to become increasingly so with AI. And so curation becomes all the more important. What is good curation, other than really the association of yourself with other products and ultimately brands? That's kind of effectively what curation is, right? And the reason that we associate ourselves with that is status. But good curation comes back to good taste. And so when you co-create with a brand, that's basically the next level, in my opinion, of association, is it's you get to associate yourself with a brand whose taste and status you respect, admire, and aspire to. And by co-creating with you, they actually affirm that taste back. And that, I'm calling it tentatively proof of taste, is it's like a consensus system of taste that we've never had before, because taste is really nebulous and really kind of whatever, airy-fairy, and very hard to pinpoint. And what is good taste? But now we have brands that we consider objectively inherently tasteful, affirming our taste. And I think that that's the kind of, that's the best consensus system that we can create around what good taste is.
Yeah, that's really interesting, especially in the context of like, I think that co-creation and putting ideas out there is an inherently like vulnerable process. And so the idea of a brand then affirming your taste as like this sort of cycle becomes really, really interesting, because you're no longer like, I think back when I was like a kid and my friends and I would like get very into like certain brands or, you know, whatever. And the idea of like actually sharing an idea and then having that brand affirm it is a really, really, 100%. It's totally life-changing. And like that to me is like, how is that going to change how we interact with brands in general?
That's a good question. I wonder about that too. I think it's more, maybe it's less like how do we interact with brands and more just like how do we interact, or how do we behave as consumers and how do we interact with other consumers? I think it changes the way that we behave on social media, for example. And this is kind of why I've been talking about, like, I actually think it's harder than taking an aesthetic photo to curate a selection of aesthetic photos that have a theme that run through them, that tie in allegorical and historical references, that like include brands that you love and whatever else. Like, that's actually a lot of work. And I think that interestingly, so Eugene Wei, obviously in his like really iconic status as a service piece, he talks about how content creation on social media became a proof of work, and that creation was the work that you were doing. And it was that proof of work that allowed you to ultimately acquire status. But I think now the work has changed from creation to curation. And that's going to be the work that we start doing more and more often on social media, is curating. And that's how we're now acquiring status, is curating basically via taste and brand association, and then ultimately achieving status. And it really, that changes, like, that's a huge transformation in what status means and how we're acquiring it. And also, by the way, on social media, when you're creating content, that requires consumption to a certain extent. You have to often consume whatever it is you're using to create content, whether it's beautiful food or beautiful furniture or what have you. And consumption typically signals wealth. The more you can consume, the better items you can consume, the better content you can create. And status is therefore always, as it always has been, tied directly back to wealth. With curation, consumption's not required. It's just, I mean, it's possible, but it's not required. What's required is taste. And taste can be learned and earned. And if status is tied back to taste, that just changes the dynamic of how we interact with social media and how we status signal.
Yeah, it's kind of, I've been thinking a lot about like how Web3 makes the internet more intimate in a lot of ways. Like I think I'm like a fangirl at this point over, I think FWB has done a really good job with their app and just like exploring a very intimate social experience that is digitally native. But what's interesting about that approach is this idea of taste over like this massive distribution of scale, which often like if you have a million subs on YouTube, you are probably making a set of sacrifices in terms of what's like real and authentic for you in order to appeal to a certain like base, which I guess is also taste to some degree, but like it feels like a shift towards taste is actually a shift towards potentially like more intimate spaces that speak to a very specific type of point of view, as opposed to trying to reach scale, which feels very different when you're doing content creation and you're just trying to like grow how many people watch you versus like trying to curate a very specific type of vibe.
Yeah. This makes me think, which I don't know if this is exactly kind of answering your question. So, but I'll kind of go in this direction. We'll see what happens. But when you think about these kind of niche communities, the trade-off 100% is distribution, right? And that takes us, I think what immediately takes you to is like the 100 true fans, whatever, which we've kind of proven is like not actually really going to be a thing. Like you need more than 100 true fans, but you need a million, maybe not. And the answer is not that suddenly you go from getting 1 cent from every, let's say, person in your community to getting $1 and all of a sudden you're so much better because everyone's paying you more because they like you, blah, 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 blah. It's actually more that you don't need to get those dollars and cents just from your community because you have all these other revenue streams. And like, obviously right now we're talking specifically about financial value accrual, but that is very important. And the idea is like, now you can create content or curate content for a niche community because you have other ways of accruing monetary value that come from, for example, co-creating with your brands or selling goods that you're able to curate or create or whatever it might be. And you don't have to rely on extracting value from your community as much as you did have to in the past.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I like the idea of like almost leaving like an entire footprint on chain of just like all of the value that you've created that just keeps coming back to you in a way.
That's definitely the hope.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I can also, like, a friend of mine was very into horseback riding when she was a kid, and she had a YouTube channel that, like, got a weird amount of subscribers all about horseback riding, and I imagine, like, a version of that where, like, she actually was able to monetize some, you know, co-creation element in that specific community that now at, you know, 25, she's still actually able to get revenue from. Like that becomes really interesting.
100%. I also like, I will say I am 100% a fan of like the niche community, smaller spaces, more comfortable spaces on the internet. I think it's a really hard place that we're going to have to like kind of fiddle our way through. And I think that when apps came out, we did the like, we're going to have an app for everyone type of thing. And now we're like kind of doing the same thing in Web3. We're like, there's going to be a community for everyone. And it's like, I don't actually know if everyone wants a community for everyone. I think we want more communities than what we have right now. Like someone, I don't remember who was making this reference, but they were like, you used to go to the gym for basketball. And then you used to go, to your point, to the barn for horseback riding. And like, those were all little communities and you were okay with going to each one because you knew you had to engage in that activity. And I 100% think there's an analogy to that on the internet, but I think we're maybe taking it a little bit too far.
Interesting. I am curious on this note, like, I think a lot about more broadly, you know, do people want, like, I would usually call it governance power, but in this context, let's call it an ownership experience in the places that we spend a lot of time. And I have this unreleased podcast, which I should totally put out, where I like interview one of my very normie friends about like, do you even want any say in how TikTok is like run? Like, do you actually care? And I'm curious when you think about like the future of consumer and what a lot of this stuff looks like, obviously, like to some degree, if you're part of a cult, your voice being heard is nice. If you're part of the Glossier cult, cool. But to what degree do you think people actually want a say in like these digital experiences like TikTok and Twitter and all that?
I don't think they want that much. That's why I think like governance is ownership. It's not an ownership experience. So like we should delineate between those two. But I think people want to control what affects them. If something directly affects them, they want to be able to control that aspect of the app, in my opinion. But if it doesn't affect them, they frankly could not care less. And they might pretend to, but like they don't. And I think what they want control over is their experience on the app. And insofar as you can allow them even a semblance of control over the way they interact with their app, that's pretty much enough. What I would say the caveat to that is the ability, and this is why I think like social protocols in Web3 are so important, is the ability to take your experience and move it elsewhere. It's going to be vital. And this is kind of a weird tangent, but I think Packy McCormick just wrote this really great piece about supernova apps and how we've entered this age of apps that ignite, go on fire, explode, and then burn out really quickly. That's the Gas, the Be Real, the whatever else of the world. And that actually that's a feature, not a bug in Web3, because if you can have an underlying protocol that allows you to maximize your experience on one of these supernova apps, but then once it burns out, take the value that you've created on that app and move it elsewhere, that's what I think consumers really care about. And that's the kind of like the height of ownership that they really are seeking, even if they don't necessarily know right now that they're seeking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Again, kind of capturing like what you've done in the past and making sure that that doesn't just like totally vanish. I think a lot about that in the context of just like a lot of my digital footprint from when I was a kid is like not there anymore. Honestly, probably a good thing though, which makes me wonder like what happens when a lot of this stuff has this like source of truth where maybe not the proudest moments are like, I don't know what the right word is, solidified on chain.
Yeah, sorry. I don't disagree with you. I do think that that's like a little concerning as well. I think that kind of leads me to my like broader point though, is like people want to control their identity and that they want ownership over, and they want ownership over what impacts their identity. But yeah. I don't think they care so much past that.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that that's kind of what you're getting at as well. And it's like, we're all our own brands. I feel like people just want ownership over their brand. Mm. And if they're contributing to other brands, they want ownership over that and they want rewards for that. But like, they don't need ownership over this other brand that isn't them and isn't theirs.
You know? Yeah. I really like that point of view. As we wrap up, one last question for you. If there was one thing that you could tell people building or thinking about Web3 consumer, what would it be?
Oh, this is such a good question. Okay, one thing that I could say about anything. People don't want to live as avatars in the metaverse yet. And they've had it for a very long time. Please, for the love of God, stop building products for avatars. If I see one more digital fashion brand for avatars, I'll kill myself. Make it AR. Like, people want to wear fashion on social media. No one's living in the metaverse yet. And like, we have this propensity in Web3 to be like, it's just around the corner. I'm like, it's not. It's not. You know? And so we got to start. I think it's like the high level, now I'm rambling, but like the high level is like build for today plus 2 years. Don't build for 10 years because I promise you won't make it. Do both. Build for 2 years and 10 years. Focus on the two.
Love that advice. I love that advice.
I mean,
I think it's a good take. And honestly, people probably need to hear it. So I'm glad that you shared it. Where can people learn more about you and read your writing and all of the things?
You can follow me on Twitter with my very complicated name, but it's just my first and last name, so it could be worse. Or read my writing on Multicoin's blog.
Yay. It was so wonderful having you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on.
This is great. Thanks for letting me ramble.
Very good rambles.